Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Great. Because it's a small group, I just wondered if we could go round and just introduce ourselves, say who we are, what context we're from, and actually what you'd like to get out of this session so that we can make it focused to meet your needs. Why have you come? What do you want?
I'm Dan Farag. I'm a service design manager from Mary Curie Cancer Care, so I work with providers and commissioners of end-of-life care to redesign systems.
And what would you like for this session?
It's really understanding how to tackle some of the barriers that people have in terms of perceptions to engaging with care, and some lessons learned, if you like.
Okay.
And then best practice.
Yep. Keep going.
Hi, I'm Marina, and I'm the fashion guy.
Can you hear it at the back?
Yeah.
Sorry, apologies. I'm definitely on there.
My colleague Danielle did a presentation earlier on. I'm overseeing our end-of-life rights advocacy project, and this is all about promoting rights and choices at the end of life, so I guess it's kind of relevant in terms of making sure that people have choices and they're aware of them. So I'd like to find out a bit more about how we can do that.
Love it, thank you.
My name is Helen. I'm a clinical lead nurse from Marie Curie. Mm-hmm. We provide nursing service for end-of-life patients at home.
Yeah.
So I'm quite interested in personalisation or patient-centred.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Thank you. And at the back?
I'm Paulina. I'm PJK. Is specialised in neurological conditions, dementia. What I want to get out of here is choices of relatives and of clients. You know, what choices do they have in end of life?
Yep.
I am Julia Lex. The lead nurse and the GSC coordinator from the same company, PGPF. I came as well to just to know about the choices of the members and the residents in the office.
I'm Veronica Lovett, commissioning manager of youth palliative care. I must apologise that I have to go and catch a train, so I'm leaving early.
Absolutely.
But really, I'm just listening to anything that tells me.
Soaking it in.
Soaking it in, yes.
Yeah. That tells you anything particular?
Well, there's been certain people mentioned patients from care homes going in to hospital inappropriately.
Yeah.
So my ears are particularly quick up about anything that can help me. Address that.
Yep.
Thank you. My name's Linda Hannibal, and I'm Commissioner in Adult Social Care. I'm currently working with CCGs on integrated plans for the future, and it's a bit like ditto, really. How can we stop inappropriate admissions?
Hi, I'm Craig, and I'm from S Manager from Cabinet Place Care Home in Liverpool. Generally looks after young adults with neurological conditions, but really telling me the standard of care falls in nursing homes and why there's such a big comparison between elderly care homes and young adult services, which is what I found.
Yep.
I'm Faye. I work at the Auckland Marches Care as a nurse unit manager. I just want to cover some information really on supporting people in adult life care to make their choices and families.
I'm Carrie Bloomer. I'm the manager at the Burton Nursing Home in Shropshire with Faye. I'll just... and to see what's out there and to make life better.
Okay, well, we'll have a look at that hopefully at the end and just check out that we've got what you came. I don't come to the table as an expert in end-of-life care. I guess I come to the table more as an expert in culture-changing care homes. But I would want to make the argument quite strongly that you can't really do any intervention in care homes without addressing the whole. And that is what My Home Life does. It does address the whole. I think all that I talk about, although it's to do with older people, I think there is direct relevance to younger people. And I think there's direct relevance to the ideas for people in at-home settings and also actually acute hospitals. So although the evidence base that I draw on is very much coming from the care home sector, I think it's actually very relevant to the other sectors, largely because what we've done is place the older person at the centre. And I always say, as a researcher, I'm sick of the research that focuses on poor practice and then blames practitioners. So what we've done is focus on what do residents, relatives and staff want, and what do we know that works. And I'll try to show how I feel end of life fits into this evidence base, and also how choice perhaps fits in. And so I want you to come in and make your own comments as we go. If you feel there's anything that you want to question or add, you are the experts, and you might have some really important things to say that I'm going to miss because I'm not coming at it from your particular expert voice. And if you feel I'm wasting your time and I'm not giving you what you want, please do stop me and let's talk about it. Okay? So I'm coming at this, as I say, from my home life. Can I just see from a raise of hands if any of you have heard of my home life before? Have you had any presentations on it, or should I make the assumption that probably need to say a little bit about it? It was an initiative that did start in 2006, and it was started by Help the Aged before it merged with Age Concern and became Age UK. So it's led by Age UK now, and it's done in partnership with City University, where I work, and Dementia UK. As you know, two-thirds of all people in care homes have some form of dementia, so it's appropriate to be in partnership with them. Our mission statement is that we're about promoting quality of life for those living, dying, visiting and working in care homes for older people. And the sort of key words here, it's about holding the living and the dying, and acknowledging both in this setting. But the other key thing is around our views on personalisation and person-centred care. We have the view and have the evidence to support that view that if you want to get it right by older people in long-term care settings, then as much as anything you have to pay attention to relationships. And in particular, the relationships between residents, relatives and staff. And if you're going to pay attention to the relationship between the resident, relative and staff, and also, I would argue, the relationship between the care home and the wider community, we've got commissioners here, etc., and people who are not working in a care home but probably working with care homes, we've got to pay attention to your relationships too, the relationships you have with care homes. Because if those relationships are not good, we are not going to get person-centred care for the older person or any age of person. And it's a strong message, because if you look at the policy on older people, it focuses on person-centred. And I think that focus in the policy too much on individuals, independence and choice. And in this setting, we're dealing with frailty and interdependence, and I think it is appropriate to focus on the relation aspects. Now, if you look at the media at the moment and you think about the Francis report, what is it telling you? It's telling you we've got a tick box culture and too much pushing focus on measurement and pushing people through hospitals too quickly, and that what's gone is the compassion, the relationships. So I think there's a lot to be learnt in the acute care sector from the care home sector. So if you're going to foster good relationships, you mustn't just think of the needs of the older person, paramount of importance though they are. You must also think of the needs of the relatives who visit and the staff who work. And sadly, I've got to tell you that it's my belief that it is the staff who get most forgotten. And we will never get there unless we start to pay more attention to that fact. So my home life began in 2006, and it was just about pulling the evidence base together. We focused on what do we know that residents, relatives and staff want, and what do we know that works. And that's what's created the evidence base that I'll talk to you a little bit about. But since then, it's sort of taken off in a way that we never imagined. And lots of people are doing lots of things in the name of My Home Life, and it's become described as a social movement. And what connects those people who are involved in it is that we're evidence-based, so we base it on this vision, we're relationship-centred, we're appreciative. I think that's really important. This is a sector that is absolutely maligned by society, and I think it's because we're an ageist society. We fear to go near end of life and dementia, and they're often described as islands of the old. People disconnect from them for a whole variety of reasons. And unless we value and respect and appreciate the contribution that they make, you know, 450,000 beds, over three times more beds in care homes than in the NHS, they are contributing massively to the care of our older people, our sickest and most vulnerable citizens in society. We need to appreciate, value and respect more, and work in better partnership, I believe, with. And the other aspect of this social movement is that what we do is always seeking to make a difference, seeking to make improvements. And really, it's quite interesting that I think a lot of you are in that ballpark too. It's been really quite a special year for us because it feels as though we've taken a whole systems approach. We've tried to tackle making improvements at grassroots level, but also influencing policy. So we work at all levels. And if you look at the Care and Support White Paper, you'll find My Home Life is mentioned three times. So we've certainly had a lot of support for what we're doing in that regard. And also, if you look at the Commission on Dignity, again, we have had special mention in that as well. So there is a sense in what we're doing is not only actually meeting the needs of those at grassroots level, but also policymakers as well. Let's just take a little swerve into the evidence base for best practice. And in terms of your handouts, I think this is important because you'll see where choice and end of life would come. But if you look at that to your handouts, quickly, the themes of My Home Life are listed on this handout, and we produce a lot of resources for care at care assistant level, DVDs, all our materials are available on the website. Rather than sort of producing academic articles on dusty library shelves, we produce bulletins, posters, things to create a dialogue. And what you'll see in terms of what's on your handout, this house, if I could just talk you through it. When we looked at the evidence base for best practice there, it clustered into eight themes. Three of the themes, I think, are around personalisation. I think you were asking about that. So somebody was. No, it was you, wasn't it? So, three of the themes focus on, and I think it's the social care sector that are most familiar with the personalisation agenda. The navigation themes, I think, are what healthcare people are most familiar with. The transformation themes at the bottom are really key messages for the care home managers to support their staff deliver the personalisation and navigation themes. Okay? Personalisation, that's about maintaining identity. See who I am. Not just about the resident, it's about see who I am, the relative who visits, and see who I am, the staff member who works. So often we do life story work, and we do it with residents. We don't really necessarily engage too much with the relatives, and probably not at all get to know each other at a deeper level in order to engage more. Now, creating community is all about the relationships both between residents, relatives and staff, and relationships between the care home and its local community. So that sense of connectedness, connect with me. And then sharing decision making, involve me, that is around how we can involve residents relatives and staff in the decision making about how the care home is run, as well as the individual's care. And I think the social care sector feel very happy with that, but I think health people need to be reminded of it. And we only need to go as far as a lit review that we recently did on acute care hospitals, and that's in the International Journal of Nursing Studies. And older people in hospital are saying nothing about clinical care. They expect it to be in place. What they are saying is, see me, involve me and connect with me. And that's why we need a dignity strategy and compassionate care, because that's the bit that's missing in acute hospitals. The navigation themes, managing transitions, that's not just the into and out of a care home. It's managing all those upheavals and losses of you're losing your independence, your frailing body, your frailing mind. So it's all the emotional aspects of work. The improving health and healthcare, well, it speaks for itself. But there's a big issue in care homes, having access to healthcare. You would expect, and they have a right to have access in the same way as you would if they were in their own home. They don't. There's a real issue there that needs addressing. And then, of course, what you're here today thinking about is supporting good end of life. So can you see how I would see the end of life bit as just one component part, but actually encourage that as you think about end of life, you also think about the personalisation theme, because that's the approach, that's how best to do it. And what fascinates me is that often I do conferences and I get the nurses in care homes coming up to me and saying, you know, Julianne, if only those care assistants would push fluids a bit more, then the resident would wake up and enjoy a better quality of life. And at the same conference, I get the care assistants coming and saying, if only those wretched nurses would stop treating this as a clinic. This is their home, and if they stop treating it as a medical clinic, then the residents would have a better quality of life. And I think all that we can see here is that we've been siloed in our education to think more about personalisation or navigation.
Sorry, yeah? The personalisation that we use, I've been a manager for 2 or 3 years. I introduced a very social model of care assessment, which was totally alien to the nurses.
Yes.
There was like a revolt for about 10 months because I didn't know how to fill it in and I thought you can write. But now, and I think Faye will probably agree, that because it is so personalised, it's about what I can do, what I can't, what I need help with, not what I can't do. There's no negatives. It's about what you can do and the deficits and how we manage that, rather than, you know, Mrs. Bloggs is incontinent, so we manage all pads. And by doing that, the relatives feel much more involved because we ask them for a life story. And by doing that, and you know the person though, you actually know who you're looking after.
Yeah.
But to introduce a social model to nurses was very difficult, and I would do it differently if I did it again. Because
yeah.
It was,
how would you do it different?
I would probably do more education around it rather than just go, there you go, this is what we're going to use from now on, and this is why I wanted to use it, because nobody could see why I wanted to use it. I think now they see it. Although we've had to adapt it because we're having a lot of fast track people who are coming to the home to die essentially within a few weeks, so we've had to shorten it. But it does work well. Is very person centred.
That's really helpful, thank you. This is an international issue, okay? Internationally, my colleagues talk about how nurses within care homes actually have become marginalised. So it works both ways, this, that their knowledge and expertise is not being taken advantage of. So I think there's an issue around nurses not actually seeing the personalisation themes, and I think there's also an issue around actually the expertise of the nurse in assessing and being able to monitor and treat. And so I think it's how we educate people. We educate them in different places and we tell them different things, and I've not succeeded, but I think we need a shared vision that integrates health and social care, and if it's not this, then let's have something else. But until we all agree what we're trying to do, and that's from government to grassroots, and it should cut across private and public, it should cut across hospitals and community, I think, you know, we're really missing a trick. We're not singing off the same hymn sheet, and we're not actually, you know, it's limited how far we'll get. At the heart of all of this is relationships, and if you look at the evidence base for quality of life, quality of care, and quality of good management, it points you to relationships. And there's been some work done at the University of Sheffield for a number of years where they've interviewed residents, relatives and staff about what makes it life good for them. And it clusters around six senses. And basically what it's saying is, if we help people feel safe, and it's not just residents, we've got to make our staff feel safe and our relatives feel safe when we visit, people have got to feel that they're part of things. They've got to be able to make connections between what's happened in the past, what's happening now and what is to come. They've got to feel they've got goals, they've got a sense of purpose. And they've got to have a feeling that they're moving towards those goals, that they're achieving. And they've got to feel that they matter, that they're significant. And I think this work is really interesting because if you look at this handout, say the first page, what they did was they took all the things that the older people said was important and fed it back to them and said, now prioritise it. And they did that for the carers and for staff, and also they did it with student nurses on clinical placement. And one of the most important things for residents in care homes to feel safe is that people know who they are. It's the life story work. For family carers, it's that when they come in, people are approachable. For staff, it's that there's good teamwork and communication. Actually, for student nurses, there's a mentor. But this gives us some really practical sound things to think about that will help each group get a sense, fulfil these senses. So I think that sort of really talks you through what the evidence base is saying. The rest of the house is just a simple message. It's saying, don't leave all of this to the care homes alone. You've got to support care homes deliver this. So the partnership working that goes on around care homes, health and safety, commissioning, monitoring, we've all got to be doing it together and in good partnership and in good relationship. And really, to make that happen, the health and social care policy has got to be more joined up. And actually, integration of health and social care is right on the button now. So I'm hopeful that we'll start to get some movement.
The companies are always rather than ones to care home. Because sometimes, especially these big corporate companies, these care homes don't complete the corporate umbrella. So I remember back when I used to work in care of the elderly, I worked for a corporate company that no longer operates. But I would be used to working as doing staff nurse on shift for 40 patients. And we run with 2 to 3 carers sometimes on day shifts, and you've got to look at how you're able to provide such a high quality of care to those residents who've got complex health needs, many different types of diagnoses. And you go to lunchtime, you'd have 40 minutes to feed the patient sometimes, and you'd have 30 patients in the dining room, 15 of whom needed feeding. You'd only be one nurse on 2 or 3 carers. How do you do that feasibly?
Be careful. Sort of going the sort of big corporate groups and the, there are 18,000 care homes and it's a really mixed bag. And if you look at quality outcomes over time, the not-for-profit care homes were and still are doing better than the for-profit care homes. But the for-profit care homes are catching up. So I don't think we can very easily sort of group. There's a lot of movement and shift, and I think we have to be careful not to speak in sort of generalised terms. But certainly what we do know, what we definitely know, is because of the policy of care at home, people are going in frailer, sicker, later, and actually the workforce itself has not necessarily been prepared for this change, and that's what we're trying to get that workforce fit for purpose. It is really important. Okay. So we conducted. I'll probably quickly tell you about a leadership program that we've developed, because this underpins what I'm going to talk about next. How My Home Life, what we do is, first of all, we pull the evidence base together for best practice. We create resources that we hope will stimulate dialogue and reflective thinking. We everything that we do with care homes in the driving seat, helping us to do it. And what's happening quite naturally is networks of care homes are building up and linked to the programme. We promote leadership, and we promote leadership at all levels, and I'll tell you about the course that we've developed that fits in with that theme. Sustaining change is another thing that I think about. What if my money dries up? How can I have influenced those in mainstream to take this on so that if we go, it still keeps going? And I think we've done quite well with that, you know, three mentions in the white paper, not bad. And then maintaining the momentum is how can we keep the spotlight positively on care homes and in a helpful way, and how can we counterbalance some of this negativity that is around and inappropriate. So we got a big message that there was a need to look at leadership in care homes, and working with the sector, and every single umbrella organisation that represents care homes is in support of My Home Life. They're a partner in it, and it's gone across national borders. There are initiatives in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. We worked with the sector, and what we've come up with is a leadership support community development programme. Leadership support, they come in for 4 days, we talk to them about the evidence base, about relationship centred care, we help them look at their own leadership style, we help them to recognise their role as change agents, and we prepare them to go into action learning. Action learning, I'll talk briefly about, but it's where they come once a month for a year, so it's a long period of time, and this action learning supports them make quality improvements in their care homes. And how action learning works is that you have a group of care home managers together, and they take it in turns to bring any issue they want from something that's troubling them in their practice, or something they even want to celebrate, whatever, something they want to talk about, and they present it, but they have a whole hour to present it. It's a long time. The others in the group ask questions of them, and they're not allowed to tell them what they think they should do. They've got to ask the sort of question that makes that person think for themselves and come to a decision themselves. And through that process, they then have to say at the end what they're going to do, and they have to report back the next time what they did and what they learned from what they did. And the presenter then also feeds back to the rest of the group saying, really like that question that you asked, that took me down this avenue, never thought about that, very helpful, thank you, really sorry that question you asked, I could tell where you were coming from, you gave too much away, it wasn't over, whatever. So they learn to be challenged and support each other with the critical feedback, and actually what they learn to do is zip it. Because a lot of the time care home managers have to tell people what to do, and zipping it means that what they're saying through the action learning, through the process of action learning, is that they're learning a different style of communication, a different style of management. They're going back into their care homes, and instead of just telling people what to do, they're enabling their staff to think more for themselves and help their staff to make decisions. And through that process, they claim that their staff then are engaging with the residents and relatives in a more relational way. And they're also really enjoying it, because for people who feel as though they're islands of their own, they're getting a network of support from each other. They're working together for a year. They stay connected. I was hearing a manager speak today. She had never been in somebody else's care home ever. And through the programme, she's now got colleagues that she regularly visits. And they talk all the time. Have you got something on or whatever? So it's been a very supportive programme to develop and enhance leadership skills. The community development bit is, we talk to the funder, usually a local authority, about, well, what are your issues with care homes? What do you want to improve? And through the action learning, we find out what the issues are for care homes. And when we find something that both the care home and the local authority are saying they want to do something about, and it could be inappropriate admission, it's usually inappropriate admission, safeguarding, quality monitoring, those sorts of things, then we bring them together in a room, and using appreciative methods, we help them to understand each other better, each other's context better, to value and respect each other more through the processes that we use, and to solve some local issue. And through that, we hope to leave them in a place of better partnership working to carry on doing the same thing with other things going forward. And so that's what we've been working on, and probably I would say 23 local authorities in England have had cohorts go through the programme. If you want to really talk to a local authority that's very excited by it, it's Essex. They have now said that they won't commission care in care homes without people having gone through this programme, and so they keep on recommissioning it. They have refashioned their monitoring team so it works much more appreciatively with care homes. They have, just Google My Home Life Essex. They've got their own website. It's astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And what Joseph Rowntree Foundation asked us to do was, if you can imagine it, we're listening to these action learning sets over a year. We're really hearing what life is like for care home managers. And what we do, the facilitator of it gathers data on what's being talked about with permission from the members, and at the end we give it back to them. We give them a report saying, these are the things that we think you've been talking about. And they have opportunity, the care home managers have opportunity to say if they think anything's been left out, if they feel we've not represented their voice properly and what we need to change, if they feel we've made them vulnerable by how we've worded something, we'll change it. And if they're happy, and when they're happy, we will then give it to the local authority. And then the local authority will have the same process. And if everybody's happy, and if they're not, we wouldn't share it with anyone. But if they're all happy, then we will add that to this building evidence base that we've got from all these cohorts across, it's just starting in Scotland, so I'll now say UK. And so the voice is getting stronger. So this work here with Joseph Rowntree was on the early cohorts of the Leadership Support Community Development Programme. And they wanted us to think about what is voice choice and control in care homes. And I think if you download the report from the web, we've got some fantastic examples of what people are doing around voice choice and control. And I think our first message is voice choice and control is about maintaining identity, sharing decision making and creating community. See who I am, involve me and connect with me. That is what voice choice and control is all about. And there are numerous examples of how people are engaging in care homes with it. And in addition to that, it's about how you then use voice choice and control and address improving health, supporting good end of life, managing transitions. It's an approach. Voice choice and control is an approach to how you go about engaging older people, residents and relatives in the decision making about how we improve health, how do we support good end of life, how do we manage transitions. And again, there are numerous examples of good practice in that report. And so what underpins it? It is very much those beautiful moments of connectedness. It's it really is all about relationships. And if we are to be relationship-centred, we have to help support and develop transformational leadership, which is different to transactional leadership, where the leaders just tell people what to do. Transformational leadership is the sort of leadership that really gets people to think for themselves and is done through being engaged with people and giving voice, choice and control. And that's the form of leadership. The research and evidence base shows that's the one that works and sustains, but it ain't what we do. But I think through the work, what we have uncovered is a little bit worrying, that actually care home managers, their role is just not appreciated. It's so complex what they do, and people just don't understand the complexity of it. They are being pulled from pillar to post. The messages that they're getting are so often conflicting. You know, it's just... A lot of them are completely overwhelmed with the paperwork and the competing pressures, coping with staffing issues. They're just being there for everyone all of the time, getting burnt out. You hear about them taking, you know, calls on their holidays. They go to bed with their phone. You're looking at each other. It is how it is. You know, these people do not get a break.
I could have written that.
You could have written it.
I could have written that. Yes.
Completely at the mercy of the demands and perceived threats. You know, unannounced. I was running a group. Suddenly this care home manager took a call. It was an unannounced inspection. And I cannot tell you the anxiety this woman had, and we tried to hold it. We tried to say, look, no, stay. No, she couldn't. It's so threatening. It's just awful. People are not clear with them about what they expect, and they're very isolated and lacking in confidence. It's on your handout, you can have a look, but the role is extraordinary. The sort of businesses that they're running, you'd probably have at least two people in a similar sized business that wasn't a care home. Sometimes care home managers are sandwiched between the proprietors and the staff, and not all care home managers actually have the autonomy and the resources to do what they know they want and should. So the challenges are enormous. They're managing from a position of fear, often adopting a mothering role, one which is, trying to look after the staff rather than actually support their staff to perhaps grow a bit and take more responsibility themselves. The fear from outside really is getting in the way of people being able to reflect and think and engage in positive decision making and positive risk taking. What do we know? If this is how they're treated, then they're going to get very anxious, and if they're anxious, they're going to pass it on to others. And actually, if they pass it on to their staff will pass it on to the residents. That is what we know. If we want voice choice and control, then we've got to role model it. We've got to be working positively with it at all levels. So what can help? Well, I think we've got plenty of evidence that the action learning has been extremely welcomed. We've got support managers go on their own journey. Everybody's at different starting points, and I don't think we can be prescriptive about this. We can just invite people to come on a journey and go at their own pace. We need to create reflective spaces so that people can just take stock and think through and revitalise. And I think we need to help them work on specific issues, because there's lots of things going on in the system that are not working well for them, and we've got to sort them out. And we've got to somehow help care homes reconnect better with their local community and with the wider health and social care system. But what we're getting through the leadership programme, we would argue, is more resilient, assertive and skilled managers. The whole atmosphere is deemed to be calmer. People are feeling much more connected, residents less withdrawn, and there's a much better engagement going on. So the key message is positive relationships is at the heart of personalisation. They're not going to just happen. They've got to be nurtured, they've got to be modelled, and they've got to be reinforced. And the care home manager is absolutely pivotal, and they will need ongoing external supervision. And that the statutory service needs to actually work in positive collaboration with care homes. And it's got to be based on mutual respect, mutual support and trust. Otherwise, we will never get this positive culture that will enable choice at end of life. We'll be on a hiding to nothing. So, thoughts or comments? I want to do a time check, shouldn't I? Yeah, we've got probably about another 5 minutes, haven't we?
I think the point you're saying about staff is true, because if we have challenging families, and you say if you do not respect the staff, why should the staff respect the resident? And it is a cyclical.
Yes.
It's got to be cyclical, because
yeah.
Everybody has to have mutual respect for everybody else,
yeah.
And without that, it just breaks down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes it is very difficult, and in heightened states of emotion, but the staff are usually very good. They just take it on the chin and stand back, and the relatives are very often so sorry, it's fine.
Okay, a quick story. A care home manager said the other day that there was a person with dementia who swerved into the hairdressing area and showed an interest in getting a haircut. So they got her haircut. Relative came in absolutely furious. How dare you cut my mother's hair? And the relative just felt gutted because the resident had been going around with a smile on her face. They thought they'd done a good job. And then suddenly the relative is like pounced on them. And the care home manager took the relative into her office. And I thought that was good because I can quite imagine how it stops there and then you get a them and us and the relationship breaks down and it's a disaster. The care manager took the relative in and said, I don't understand why you're so upset. We've done our best. We've got her hair done. She's looking happy. What's the issue? So the relative said, well, that's my job. I take her out to do that. Ah, right, I get it. So she said, well, why? What we'll do next time is we'll try to swerve her away, try to distract her. But can we agree that if we can't distract her and she really does want her hair cut, that actually her needs are greater than yours and that we will do her hair? And the relative said, it's not really even that. It's the fact that I came in and I didn't recognise my mother. And the way you've cut her hair is not like how I get it cut. And that's the only thing that's left in my mother. That's the only thing I recognise. And you've taken that away from me. And the care home manager then said, oh my goodness, I can see what you're saying. Okay, we'll try to swerve her. If we can't swerve her and we do need to get the hair cut, we'll take a photograph and we'll try and cut it in the way that you recognise. At that point, the relative broke down, started sobbing, saying, look, just do whatever you need to do. I'm just grieving. I trust you to make the right decision. That is really sophisticated stuff. And that care home manager, I take my hat off, but I do see how it could have broken down at a far earlier stage.
It is very difficult because you end up being like a social worker most of the time. I had a lady the other day, I was asked to go and assess somebody in hospital on the fast track, went in, did the assessment, spoke to the lady who was very poorly, got back, and the next day I had a daughter in my office yelling at me, how dare you assess my mother? I haven't said she can come in. I went, hang on a minute. And by the time she left, she said, thank you very much. So I said, I actually didn't know. I said, but don't make a decision about, she had an NG tube and then she knew that when she took it out, that was going to be it. And I said, don't make that decision on your own. Get your family around, you've got all weekend. And she left going, thank you so much. You're the only person who's spoken to me about it. But it's so hard because you could just go, well, it's not my fault.
It's very complex work.
It is, and it's time consuming as well, apart from all the paperwork and stuff and the pregnancies and this and that and the others.
It's the most complex skilled work undertaken by care assistants, sometimes paid less than the checkout desk of Tesco. It's wrong. And we've got to do everything we can to support them do the fantastic job that they do. You know, they're looking after the people that everybody else has given up on. So, we wanted to think about barriers to engaging. I think what the care home managers have to say through the action learning sessions is a lot of insight into some of the issues. We have looked at the evidence base for best practice in care homes. Choices around end of life, I think maybe not. I think you're the experts in that, and I think my message would be, don't just focus on that. See the bigger picture. Understand how it's the culture of the home that will support choices at end of life. It's not one bit. You need to think about the whole. Personalisation at home, I think the themes of see me, include me and connect with me, those personalisation themes I think are very relevant both in care homes and at home and actually in hospital. That's what is missing. Thinking about choices and how do we support residents and relatives, well, I would encourage you that it's not just them. I'd encourage you to think that it's residents, relatives and staff. People are enduring a living bereavement. These staff are getting close to people and they're dying day in, day out. We have to put in support mechanisms for them to deal with all the losses and upheavals that they are feeling, as well as the resident preparing for death and the relative who's grieving also. Inappropriate hospital admission, I think through the community development strand, I think there is a big message about valuing, respecting, partnership working, recognising skills expertise, and not looking down as an NHS on the independent sector. I think we've got to really give some thought to that, because we are as vulnerable to society's negativity as anybody else. And improving care homes practice. Well, I hope we've addressed that. So can I thank you for coming and wish you well in what you do and hope to see you.
Thank you.
Were we meant to have signed in? I don't know. There's some names on there, but I don't know whether we're meant to or not. Your shout.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Great to see you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.